Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, September 3rd, 2009, going right into the show. And the original three-part series dealing with misconceptions regarding our good friend Planet X and the many Planet X objects is really being extended. There was so much material to cover. There was no way I was going to cover this in three shows. In fact, there will be this show and at least one more. But these are the questions that people want to know. These are things that, there's just so much misinformation. And then within that, I try and mix in a little bit of positive information. So tonight's show is going to be a bit more positive. I've been asking questions and then answering them, typically showing how the answer is no to many misconceptions, but then qualifying it with some real information. So tonight's show will actually be dealing with lessons of the great comets and catastrophes. That's kind of the subtitle for tonight's show, Lessons of Great Comets and Catastrophes. And so before I go into that, I've got a few quick announcements. Of course, this past week, the passing of Ted Kennedy, senator, longtime senator from Massachusetts, but obviously involved in a lot more than just being a senator. I saw a picture that I thought very interesting. I don't know where I saw it. It was in one of the news web pages. But at the funeral, there was a kind of a side picture down one of the pews of the church, and it had a picture of Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and now these are all people standing with their face profiles all in a row. Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, George Bush Jr., Laura Bush, his wife, and then Obama with his wife, all boom, 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 right in a row. And to me, it just spoke of what we call CFR, Council of Foreign Relations. And all of these people belong to these groups. They are groups that have been formed over the past century and literally were formed to control, to get in the businesses, to get in politics, to get their people into every corner of your life and the world to run things. They run the world. These are the families. They need these worker bees out there. I often thought about Ted Kennedy and a lot of these people. How come they don't just chill out and go? They retire, hang out. They got tons of money. But they're there working. They are there with, they're kind of, I think, kind of psychotic, nutty people. They just can't give it a rest. They can't go off and let it go. Just take a vacation, folks. You know, but they gotta be out there running the world, making sure that they're still in control. And that's the group of people I'm talking about. But also the people behind them that you never see. You never see their faces or their names, pulling the puppet strings on all these people. But anyway, the one thing, when I think of Ted Kennedy, the one thing that comes to my mind is a guy named Paul Wellstone. Now, the scenario was, I don't remember the exact year, but I know it was election year for the senatorial race, and Wellstone was the well-chosen winner. He was about to win and continue on as senator from Minnesota. And at about 4 o'clock in the morning at a small private airport in downtown St. Paul, as Paul Wellstone, his wife and daughter, got on a small private chartered plane to fly up to northern Minnesota for a political meeting, there was Ted Kennedy shaking his hand, making sure that him and his wife and daughter were on that plane, shook Paul Wellstone's hand at 4 in the morning, St. Paul on a crisp fall morning, and about 2 hours later, Paul Wellstone's plane blew up in the air, two massive explosions blew the plane apart as it came in about 1,000-foot elevation for a landing at the airport. I think it was Bemidji or Brainerd, Minnesota, one of the northern Minnesota small towns. And according to the FAA report that I heard, the lady who at the time was the head of the Federal Aviation Administration gave an announcement that two massive explosions blew the plane apart in the air about 1,000 feet off the ground. And when the rescue crews got there about a half an hour later, the metal on the aircraft tail was still burning. Now, this took a very serious explosion, whether it was inside the plane or whether it was a rocket from outside, nobody really knows. But anyway, getting back to Teddy Kennedy, that's my recollection of Teddy Kennedy. And also, oddly enough, when John Kennedy Jr. went down in the exact same scenario in a small private airplane under very similar conditions, it was Teddy that okayed the cremation of his body, so there was no evidence. And there in that case, there was John Kennedy Jr., who certainly would have been senator from New York. He had just come back from Canada and had announced that he was going to, in private circles, to run for senator of New York. And guess who was going to run for that office too? Hillary Clinton. And the estimate was that she would have lost by such a large margin it would have destroyed her political career forever. And of course, right now, we would probably not have Obama as president. We would have John Kennedy Jr. Sitting in that office. Isn't that interesting? And of course, Paul Wellstone at the time was the tiebreaker on all of the voting that was going on for the wars in Iraq. And I remember hearing Paul Wellstone on the news say, "I've been in politics too long to be bought and paid for and told how to vote on these issues." They needed him out of there, and these, as they say, the rest is history. So we have, in fact, developed an expression regarding Ted Kennedy: don't shake hands with Ted Kennedy, and I guess you won't have to worry about that anymore. On to the rest of the show. India, this past week, lost radio contact with its moon orbiter. And this spacecraft had been orbiting the moon, taking high-resolution photos of the surface of the moon 300 days into its mission. And 3,400 orbits of the moon, they lost contact. But isn't it interesting that never, never, with all of the pictures it took, 3,400 orbits of the moon, in almost a year of orbiting the moon and taking high-resolution photography photos of the lunar surface, it never, ever reported seeing Apollo landing craft on the moon. But now it seems like they're just going to drop this as if that's the end of the story, and the public will never see that data. Obviously, well, you can make your own decisions there, but that was always one of my comments. With all of the spacecraft orbiting the moon, taking pictures, you had Russia, you had the European Space Agency, India, and Japan all taking, and China, by the way, all taking high-resolution photographs of the moon. Nobody saw the alleged lunar Apollo landing sites. And now it's been very quiet from the NASA regarding our very own orbiter that is going around the moon. And they showed some little smudges on a picture around last July for the 40th anniversary of the alleged Apollo landings. But at any rate, well, just another story in the saga of keeping information from the public. Of course, this past week, Hurricane Helene, bearing down on the Baja California coast and, of course, gaining much energy as it went up the Baja And I'm sure you've seen all of that on the news. Once again, as I reported before, a bit more activity in the Gulf Coast or in the Pacific than in the Gulf and Caribbean this year regarding storms. Here we are in September, and once again, very low activity. And I got a kick out of the, I forget which webpage it was on, but they reported the Atlantic hurricane season and the number of named storms in the Atlantic versus the prediction. And NOAA was revising its prediction. And they had some blog notes down below. And one of the first ones said, I loved it. It said, gee, if NOAA and the National Hurricane Prediction Center keep revising their predictions, by the end of the season, they might just get it right. And, of course, that's exactly the scenario. If you get to revise your prediction halfway through and then two-thirds of the way through and three-quarters of the way through, well, gee, you're probably going to be pretty accurate at the end and pat yourself on the back and get another annual round of federal funding. There you go. But the Pacific has been a bit active this year with storms, with named storms, but certainly nothing to write home about, which brings up the next topic. Can Bill Gates stop hurricanes with his new... Now, when I first read this article, this topic, a few weeks ago, it sounded like Gates had already gotten his patent. But now Standard Science, which, of course, has no clue what causes hurricanes, Standard Science is coming out and saying that Bill Gates' idea is not really feasible. I love it. Bad science criticizing bad science. I just love it. I just can't believe how, you know, what the garbage they put out there, and the public just reads this and has no clue that they're, you know, once again, tier two science, which is totally incorrect regarding hurricanes, you know, that hurricanes are somehow caused by warm ocean water. We just saw Hurricane Bill a week ago up in the North Atlantic, just a whopping big hurricane up in the North Atlantic, no water, no warm water at all, and just doing swell. As I pointed out, if you want to get a real dose of bad science, read my and the criticisms of bad Tier 2 standard science, read my weather book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. The first part of the book is dedicated to showing you why standard science is just completely incorrect and couldn't possibly be correct, and it's written at a level that the average person can understand. And then I love this, the article I read regarding this, Can Bill Gates Stop Hurricanes? Scientists Doubt It, was an article from CNN this past week. Then they talked to the alleged world-renowned hurricane expert, William Gray. He's the guy that told all the school kids in Florida to stay in school as Hurricane Floyd approached land 90 miles offshore, and if it would have made a uncharacteristic turn, could have killed millions and millions of school kids in Florida back in about 1999. But the problem with Bill Gates' idea, what he wants to do, is take a bunch of barges out that can pump water from deep in the ocean up to the surface of the water and cause a cooling and therefore reduce the hurricane. Of course, I have my own concept that would diminish hurricane energy in that you have to ground it offshore. It's an electrical grounding of the hurricane, and that's described in my weather book. So, as I said before, you have bad Tier 2 science criticizing a bad idea by Bill Gates based on their bad science. It's just incredible. Not to mention the ecological effects of trying to pump massive amounts of low ocean water up to the surface. Can you imagine the absolute ecological disaster that these would cause with the fish, with the wildlife? Good grief. And in this article, nobody even mentions that. Just another quick note here on, by the way, last week I talked about half of the show, I would say, on health maintenance and health care in the United States and actually in the world, and I talked about the swine flu. And just a lot of people would wonder what that has to do with Planet X and the misconceptions regarding Planet X. Well, it's very important to understand the manipulation of facts, the manipulation by the medical and the pharmaceutical industries, and the cooperation of the world leaders in all of this, with Obama spearheading it for all of them, to try and gain control of one of the things that is very controlling of the public, and that's your health care. The very simple answer, and of course when you read the fight back and forth between Republicans and Democrats or the news media reporting, nobody gives the public the chance to say, we don't want the government involved in health care. It's the wrong person. They're saying, oh, well, the insurance companies are ripping off the public and we have to come in and save that. Well, no, they're the ones who allowed it in the first place. And so if you think that big business is not going to be a big winner in the new Obama health care plan or any health care plan, then you have another thought coming. And the only people that I know support this are people that are going to make out big time by the whole process. But anyway, on to another quick topic. This reported this is Nebraska, I believe. Yeah, Nebraska announces its second alleged H1N1 flu victim, and a woman who of 20 years old died, they say, of H1N1 flu. Now, here's the title, and then I'll talk to you about the reality. It says, this is from MSNBC.com, and they got it from the Omaha Channel. The title, Health Officials, Douglas County Flu Death Reported. Okay, it sounds like this woman, they're reporting that someone died of swine flu. And then the first line, health officials said H1N1 virus has claimed a life of another Nebraskan, this time in Douglas County. And so at the news conference, this woman, who's the head of director of Douglas County Health Department, said that she had been ill for less than a week, but also qualified that the woman had underlying health problems believed to be neuromuscular disorder. The woman was confined to her home, and this woman was very ill to begin with. So did she die of the flu, or did she even have the flu? I often wonder that. There are many people that have been reporting the way they test for the flu is really a bogus test. But at any rate, the other woman who allegedly died from the flu in Nebraska was 50 years old, and she had health complications also, which I believe were respiratory. She had chronic health problems at age 50 and died allegedly from the swine flu. But there again, just the false reporting that they will say somebody died from the flu. They are just dying to claim that people are dying from this flu. And so the statistics are very skewed. And the problem here is that the health officials, the public officials, go along with this hook, line, and sinker. One little other note here this past week, there was a new high-security Wi-Fi system developed, and I love this part, that within 1 minute, the hackers had already hacked through this alleged super-security system for Wi-Fi. And, of course, Wi-Fi is when you take your computer or internet-ready telephone to a coffee shop or a hotel lobby or wherever they have Wi-Fi, and people can sit there and look at what you have on your computer, can go in and get your email, read it. They can basically get on your computer and just run it just like you do, sitting right down the hall from you. So at any rate, I just think it's comical that everybody thinks Wi-Fi is so great, and it's the super security system. This is what just makes me laugh, because, of course, I've worked in encryption. I've worked in these type of topics, and there is no good encryption. Let's put it that way. There just isn't. And for a long time, of course, it was based on prime numbers, and prime numbers, of course, went asunder with my book, Calculate Primes, the ability to directly calculate prime numbers, something that no one ever thought would happen. But I got a kick out of this. Within 1 minute, the hackers had hacked through this alleged high-security Wi-Fi system. On to this topic. Oh, by the way, just one little topic regarding the flu, and I actually heard this from a health official, and a national health official, and he's a medical doctor. I believe it was on an interview that I saw on the internet. It was one of the video interviews. But it's the first sane, absolutely correct information I have heard from a medical doctor. He said, and I forget his name, I'm sorry, but it was just flashing by, and I saw the I didn't catch his name, which was given at the beginning, because I was just expecting more garbage reporting. But he said, regarding the flu, if you get sick, don't go to the emergency room. He said the emergency room is not going to be able to do anything for you. If you're sick, just stay home. He said 99% of all the people out there, he said the vast majority of people, are just going to fight this flu off and do just fine. He didn't say one word about getting a shot. He said, basically, isolate yourself, stay home, take care of yourself, get rest, the standard things you do for flu, and basically said that this swine flu is a very mild form of flu. And now, let's go back to last April and before, when I said, okay, the end of April is going to be a time when we're going to get a blast of a new strain of flu. And the reason for that is we had a small comet which was stretching out the tail of Venus with an exact electrical alignment. And I said, we are going to be going through a region of Venus's tail, comet tail basically, which develops viruses, where in the Chinese, of course, have the track record going back to the 1200s. That's where the swine flu comes from. It's during the inferior conjunction of Venus. This is in the medical journals. This is well documented by the Chinese. The swine flu comes from the tail of Venus, from our when Earth passes through the tail of Venus. And so I made some calculations about exactly when we would be going through that tail. And wow, lo and behold, people started getting a variation of swine flu that we had not seen before. There's nothing magical about that, but it's very clear that during that same time, and I predicted this too, I said this would be a time when the bio nutcases, the military bio nutcases, would try and inject a bio sickness into communities, and it looks like Mexico City was their city of choice, to try and inject some kind of bio virus in the mix to see how the population responded, to try and get its agenda through. Of course, the Obama's administration jumped on that and said, oh, we all need the flu shot now, and everybody needs to get a shot. Shot, shot, shot. Everybody needs a shot. And so that was the reality. Now they're claiming that this swine flu variation that was introduced last April, and of course it came from the tail of Venus, from that new region of the tail where we had not been through, at least for a very long time. I would suspect that some of these variations may have been around maybe hundreds of years ago, but have dissipated and mutated out of recognition. But the viruses are created in the electrical conditions of the comet tail. And so at any rate, now, of course, they're using this for political means and to advance agendas like national medicine, control of the public's medical, and to give you a shot. They want everybody to get the shot. So at any rate, but back to this doctor that I saw, he said nothing about taking a shot. He said simply isolate yourself. And by the way, if you are healthy and a lot of people in your area are getting sick, the remedy is the same. Isolate yourself. Very simple. The swine flu is transmitted from touching things, from, say, kissing people or directly touching bathroom sink facilities or things like that, where that flu virus can hang out for just a little while. Somebody grabs the faucet at the workplace or at school, and then you grab it and you pick up the virus. Then you don't wash your hands, and or you bring it in on your shoes. So the two things you do not wear your shoes in your house. Have your front door where everybody leaves their shoe on a little pad there, and then whether they're guests or whatever, the serviceman fixing the furnace, whatever, shoes at the door, buddy, because you don't know where those shoes have been. You don't want it tracking that virus in your house. And then keep your sink area clean and wash your hands when you come into the house, when you get to work. If you've gone to the gas station and pumped gas, you got to grab that handle that everybody else has grabbed. When you get home, wash your hands. Very simple. And if the flu virus really gets to be an epidemic where everybody around you is sick, stay home for a few days. Just stay away from people. Stay well. And if you do get sick, stay home too. That's the solution. Take care of yourself. Have some chicken noodle soup on hand, some crackers, things that you would eat during the time when don't use dairy products or eggs. Those things the virus feeds on, so don't eat that kind of food. And just take care of yourself as you normally would. You don't need the shot. This is not the massive, bizarre pandemic that they're trying to strap onto the public here. Okay, well, enough of that. On to the main show topic tonight. Once again, the lessons of great comets and catastrophes. Now, I've said over and over again, and it just about drives me crazy, because every now and then somebody will email and they'll go, well, what's the date of Planet X arrival? What's your latest estimate? I don't estimate dates, past, present, or future. I don't estimate dates unless I have hard scientific data. And I remember when this whole topic of Planet X first became popularized, all of the disinformation people were going, McCanny has to predict. He has to make his prediction as to when Planet X is coming. And I said, I don't do that. You know, and they just couldn't get me to budge on that. And I said, nope, I don't make predictions. So the bottom line is, at this current time, there is no specific date. Everybody wants to know a date, and that is used very effectively by the disinformation crews, because they keep giving people false dates. 2012, whoa, May 15, 2003, every spring, there were people coming out, misinformation people, coming out and saying that, oh, this June there will be asteroids that collide with Earth and the demise of all of us, etc. So people love dates, but the reality is there is no date at this time. As much as you would like to hear a date, we don't have one at this time. And if I did, I would certainly give it to you. If NASA has a date, they certainly will not give it to you. But back to the topic of what happened in the past, of course, the Colburn, the Old Testament, every text from every country of every civilization around the world refers to the time when the great comets came through the solar system, and they're very specific. The petroglyphs and Indian rock paintings, the native paintings of the American Southwest, the cover of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book has a very nice picture from Green River, Utah, of a Indian glyph, and we don't know how ancient that is or what the dating of that glyph was, but it shows two of the large comets. And the reason you know they're large is because the helical spike in front indicates a very high magnetic field, charged particles moving in a magnetic field. And that, of course, is the sunward spike, which is part of the plasma discharge explained by my plasma discharge comet model. It's a discharge of the solar capacitor, but of immense proportions. Not the kind that we see in our everyday life with comets of recent years, the small to medium-sized ones. Like Hale-Bopp was about a medium-sized comet, but can you imagine a comet so big that it takes up the entire sky? It stretches from, when you look at it, it stretches across the entire sky. And remember that if we ever see one of these things come through the solar system, that the disinformation crew and NASA and all of the standard news media be out there, oh, don't mind that. That's just a little snowball. Just that little snowball up there. Oh, it's just a mile across. Don't, and then you'll see the tails flailing around and you'll see the electrical discharges snapping to the planets and they'll be telling you, don't mind that. That's just that electrical snowball. You know, but just a little snowball. At any rate, the lessons of the comets from the past, not all of them directly affect Earth, but we can get some horrendous weather because they kick up the sun and cause a tremendous amount of solar activity. So Earth can be cloudy, and that's one of the things that became very clear to me, is that the ancient people were looking through severe weather, earth weather, up into the heavens to see this. When Moses saw the pillar of fire reaching up into the sky as a vast tornado, and at the time there were electrical discharges, the earthquakes were going on at the time, the rumbling earth. Velikovsky explains all of this very well and has excellent references to all of the ancient texts. And that was during the Venus event, not Planet X, but the Venus event, when the Venus comet came through the solar system and eventually became the planet Venus. The Mayans are very specific that we encountered Venus, the comet, Quetzalcoatl, on two different occasions, 54 years apart. And it apparently was the second encounter that was really the bad one, the closer one. The one where the cities were just shaken to their knees. The mountains were, we had mountain building events. Not all the mountains in the world were built at that time. And this was just a little addition on what was already there. We had a tremendous amount of rain come in. The ocean levels rose by about 200 feet. And we had incredible glaciation of the world. The poles tilted by about 35 degrees. And what was the old North Pole, the what we call the Laurentian ice sheet, melted very rapidly and carved out the Mississippi River Valley. It carved out all of those big ravine systems out to Oregon, all the way to the ocean. And then the big washes that go from the Colorado Rockies down through New Mexico out to the ocean. We can see all of the disaster that came from that. So that is what happened in the past. And that event was not the worst of the events during Earth's history. I'm sure there were times during the dinosaur era, and there were times during the many of the mass extinctions when large celestial objects came through the solar system. They're quite rare, but when they do come in, they have an entire entourage of smaller objects orbiting them, and those objects can peel off, they can be pulled away with the gravitational field of the outer planets, especially of Jupiter, of Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. And even if one of those came near Earth, Earth could affect the gravitationally affect the motion. And there's a lot of misconceptions out there that somehow electrical or magnetic fields change orbits. And it's really not true, because there's a great deal of electric and magnetic shielding going on out in outer space, in the plasma environment of outer space. So, and that's one of the problems with having a bunch of uneducated clowns running around the internet pretending they're experts at electrical conditions in the solar system when they know absolutely nothing. They've never taken a physics course. They've never taken any kind of courses. In general, they don't have any degrees at all. Some clowns claiming to be plasma physicists, all kinds of crazy people running around pretending that they're something they're not, but putting out misinformation. But the reality is that gravity is the glue of the solar system. That's what makes things move. That's what makes things change orbits, etc. And the electric and magnetic fields have other properties. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on that. That is all explained in my books. But understand that the gravity is the gravitational waves also coming from these passing objects are the things that create our mountain ranges, that take Earth's crust and move it around and crack it and cause plate tectonics. And so right now when we see plate tectonics working, it is just the Earth relaxing from these major events. When we see like the ring of fire that wraps from all the way to the tip of South America and comes around up the western coast of California, up around Alaska and down to Japan. Those big plate boundaries, that's called the ring of fire. Of course, it's volcanically active and earthquake active. And these are the results of the Earth getting wrenched severely as one of these objects comes by. And this has happened many times throughout history. The various mountain building events, the Alps Mountains built in a very short period of time, but not by the Venus event, by previous large passages of comets and being added to or changed slightly during the Venus event. You have to understand that these events have happened many, many times, and therefore this is additional. Each time it happens, the Earth changes, it adds, it subtracts. Continents that were above the water get pushed down. Things that were below the water get pushed up. Where was it I just was reading about another incident of undersea activity becoming very obvious above high at a very high elevation. I don't always get to clip these articles when I'm in quickly moving through them, but I remember being out in the Colorado Rocky Mountains a number of years ago, up to the very top, probably 14,000 feet up in the mountains. These tremendously crushed systems of rock that are in the peaks up there, and guess what? Seashells crushed in the rock at those elevations, embedded in the rock. And so those were probably at a point way underwater at some point. Now very high, 14,000 feet elevation in the Rocky Mountains. And this is common all over the world. This is common in the Andes, mountains of South America, the Himalayas in Europe, etc. So, and that's one of the things that Velikovsky pointed out. There's all of these things around the world that just don't seem to fit in. There's a term in geology called moraines. A moraine is a region that just doesn't fit. And one of the more common ones is where you have, something that was developed underwater or deep underwater, and all of a sudden around it is like, say, a desert or some other landscape that was developed for a long period of time above the sea level. And so that's called a moraine, some piece of geological territory that just does not fit in with the surrounding territory. Excuse me, I had to take a sip of water there. And by the way, filtered water from my Dalton water filter. The one lesson that we should have learned from the great comets and the great catastrophes is that we need to use our time and resources wisely. Now, here's the problem. We know this is going to happen again. I don't care if it's next year or in 100 years. We don't have the capability developed at this point to get large numbers of people into space. The ridiculous NASA moon program is certainly not going to cut it, where they want to, in 20 or 50 years, get a man to Mars. What an absolutely ridiculous goal. Back in the 60s, when Kennedy said, we want to get a man to the moon and bring him back safely, that was a, at that time, that was a perfect goal, because it was just to show we could do it, develop the technology, and he knew that if we had all that technology developed, getting more people to the moon would be the natural result of it. But what happened? Well, Kennedy was dead. Nixon was in office. NASA couldn't get to the moon, and as far as we can tell, they faked it. So that's what happened, and then after a couple of alleged Apollo launches, NASA scraps the program, completely dismantles the Saturn V rocket system, which they cannot duplicate now, once they're going to try again. And they dismantle the Saturn V launch complex and everything that goes with it. They destroy all of the information and engineering notes and leave a couple pieces of the old Saturn V rocket at the Smithsonian Institute, and that's it. They stop. Then they go, oh, well, now we're going to build the shuttle, and we're going to spend the next 10 years, and we can't get into space, by the way. And there's all of this kind of negative press about Russia. Understand that during the Apollo program in the 60s and up to about 1976, Russia was launching manned launches into space at the rate of about one per day. They also had a little experimental shuttle vehicle because they had so much launch capability as far as weight, getting weight into space, that they put a little shuttle, a three-man shuttle vehicle, re-entry vehicle, on the tip of their rockets, and there were something like 1,600 launches of that vehicle during that time period, from about 1965 to about 1976. That vehicle was called the Cosmos series, and it was a small shuttlecraft. I've got pictures of that. You can see pictures of it if you have the video of my talks at the UFO Congress that are now on DVD. The pictures of the Cosmos vehicle are there. And as I said, the data on the number of launches is very well documented in U.S. Annals of Space History. But the Western press, of course, doesn't want to notify the public that while we were waiting for our one guy to launch to the Apollo program, Russia was launching every day, and they have been ever since. They have an incredible launch program in central Russia, and they still do. And now that we're in an era where the shuttle is being phased out, Russia still is launching, and the only way the U.S. is going to get into space is to contract the Russians to launch their junk. Which is very interesting, because they keep trying to pawn off this idea to the public in the U.S. that the Russians don't have a viable space program. The Russians have a very viable space program. This, when the guy came up to me just the other day, and he was, I know I had announced this many times before, being on radio shows, etc., that back in the part of the space development era, NASA contracted companies to develop a pen that would write in outer space. And they spent millions and millions of dollars trying to develop this pen that would be able to write in the weightless environment of outer space. And the Russians used a pencil. It's just an example of, you know, what the Russians did. A pencil doesn't, it'll work in gravity or a non-gravity environment. And so they still do. The Russians had redundancies. If you look at the Russian spacecraft, the manned spacecraft, it's basically tubes and tanks with valves. And the valves they turned by hand. There was nothing computerized about it. When they wanted more oxygen, they would turn a valve by hand. And then if they wanted less oxygen, they turn a valve by hand. And then the atmosphere would be pumped out, revitalized in a cell, and then replaced back in the tanks. A very simple system, and they had multiple redundant systems, sometimes up to 10 redundant systems. And if one broke, no big deal. You had 10 other ones to work. So at any rate, the Russians had a very different philosophy. It was not all computerized. It was very simple, and it worked. And it works to this day. And that's why when the Chinese went to get technology for their space program, they went to Russia. They didn't come to the United States. They wanted to get something done. And that's why China is very much fast-tracking it to space, because they bought into Russian technology. They bought Russian launch technology. They bought Russian guidance technology. They bought the Russian ability to have two spacecraft meet in space. The docking mechanisms, etc., was all purchased from the Russians for a very reasonable price. And that's why China is going to be a very big contender in outer space. And they have a program, and of course they're not strapped with the great overhead of corporate profit that the United States has in its space program, where corporations are making vast amounts of money and the space program is lagging seriously, because big executives and high-paid engineers are getting a lot of dough for what they're doing, and we're not getting the job done here. We're falling very far behind. The Chinese have a very efficient system. And by the way, once you get into outer space, where are you going to spend your money? There's no place to spend money up there. So the whole concept of how to live in space is going off to other countries. I want to compare this to the Middle Ages, after the discovery of the New World by Columbus. And of course, we all know the Vikings were here first, so don't give me that. I understand that. But the real wave of development and exploration started after Columbus came back with information. Columbus came back. He was back to the islands within a couple years. And then the great age of exploration started out. You had the Portuguese, the Spanish, and the English, and you also had the Mediterranean merchants that were going out and starting to venture farther and farther out, build bigger boats, understand navigation, develop clocks that were needed for navigation, charts, and all of this was being developed by private enterprises. And now look at what happened back then. The Portuguese were on the western coast of Europe, right on the Atlantic. They were some of the first ones out. They did some of the most innovative early exploration, but then early on fell by the wayside. They didn't have the wherewithal to keep it going. Then Spain came along, developed, and Spain, remember, was a relatively very poor country at the time. And so was England. They did not have a great deal of resources, so they had to go out and get those resources, the shipbuilding. The Irish were big on shipbuilding. A lot of the shipbuilding actually took place in Ireland for the English. But at any rate, to see how the entire history of the world unfolded, who were the big winners and who were the big losers in the end, and of course, England had a big presence worldwide for about 600 years in the ocean, maintaining control of the ocean. The expression still existed up to the end of the 20th century that the sun never sets on the English Empire, and that was all built through the Middle Ages through shipping. And those were the big winners, the people that had the commitment, it stuck to it, and developed it and had the navies. Now we are in a critical time also in terms of space exploration, which is very similar. The United States is falling critically behind in all avenues of space exploration because we have presidents who have no clue about what they're doing. the Bush directive to go to the moon again and try and repeat the alleged Apollo program and then maybe get a guy to Mars is absolutely ludicrous. The point that should be made now is we should be sending large space stations where large volumes of people live in outer space and can exist in space autonomously. That is the lesson of the great comets. But, as with all of the lessons, these are being put aside for corporate profit and ideological goals that make absolutely no sense in the bigger picture, in the bigger scheme of things. So when you start to see history develop, and you start to see the United States in future being shown in its decline, when it's going down, and you know the rape of the American public financially, and allowed through as greed permeates all of Washington and New York, the Eastern Seaboard, where you have Wall Street coupling with the banking system with Washington. Owning Washington, owning Congress, owning the legislative department, where all of these people should be in prison. We have a foreign bank running our currency. We have totally lost control. And underlying all of this is our total inability in the area of science. We have monopoly groups that have come in science and are teaching totally outdated, incorrect science in the schools, in the universities. And it's a matter of money and control. Who gets the funding? Who gets their papers published? Who gets the to travel around and fly around the world on what I call scientific vacations for free? And who gets to get the PhDs in the subjects that are administered by this entire system? That entire system is so corrupt and broken that it cannot possibly be repaired. And of course, part of this is a very intentional part of this is tier two science that keeps the public very stupid. So it's a very intentional movement to keep the public from getting into space. The one great lesson of the great comets and the great catastrophes is that you have to get the population in mass into outer space, autonomous, so they can live completely independent of Earth. That is being totally stifled. When Bert Rutan won the XPRIZE, immediately the FAA had to be in there writing up rules and regulations about how you could design spacecraft to go into space. And then Congress was passing legislation saying that trying to have international coverage and control of technology that was developed in the United States. Sorry, guys, this is out of their control. They don't even understand that the legislation they're trying to pass, and did pass, has no effect on groups and other people. All it's doing is slowing down development in the United States, slowing down the ability of the common man in the United States to go into outer space. Outer space should be like surfing. You see the guys out on surfboards surfing in the ocean, developing new, faster, better types of surfboards. And, you know, the FAA keeps saying, well, we have to do this for the safety of the public. Well, they let NASA fry 14 astronauts and didn't care anything about their safety. But the real reason it's not for the safety, when anybody tells you they're doing something for your safety, look for that's the superficial reason. Look for the real reason. The real reason is because if the public starts to go into space in mass in private space programs, then what's it going to make NASA look like with its 20-year program to try and get one man to the moon? They're going to look absolutely ridiculous, which they do anyway. But the point is that NASA has a monopoly. They have a guaranteed government income of about $17 billion a year, and they are a front agency for a real space program that is doing real space research. The big telescopes, all of the information that comes from them, goes off and is filtered first. There's a whole level of science, tier one science, that nobody gets to see. And you have the tier two scientists who think that they are the top rung of science in the world, and they really aren't. The vast majority of those people have no clue. There is an entire layer of science above them that is pretty much chuckling at what they're doing and don't respond to them and use them as if they do something good, that's taken. If they do junk science, then please pass that off to the public. That's what we want the public to see. So once again, back to the great comets, the lessons of the great comets and catastrophes, they do occur. They occur somewhat regularly. We don't know exactly when the next one is going to be, but let's say, for example, this is a hypothetical example and not giving a date, but let's say 100 or 200 years. Say we knew that we would be free of any catastrophes for 100 years, and then something big's going to happen. We would be hard-pressed in that 100 years to get large volumes of people into space, given what we would have to do today. Actually, if the world's science development teams and engineering teams put their minds to it, they could probably do it overnight. Bert Rutan got into space to win the X Prize in record time with a very innovative design. So all of these things can be done, but the perception and leadership is totally clueless. They don't make decisions on the big issues. If you're a leader, the first thing you should do is take the biggest issue out there, and that is getting into outer space on a permanent basis with large numbers of people. How can we take our society and develop that? Secondly, get rid of the foreign banking systems that are dominating this the world we live in, and put it back in the hands of the people. So as we have things today in the world, we are a doomed race, doomed to repeat the same mistakes of the past, to be totally unprepared for when these major events occurred. There, with the great efforts to hide the truth on all fronts. Remember that the people of the past have left us ample information to understand what happened, to understand how people should live, and to understand that the real message is that we have to develop space programs to get people into outer space if we're going to preserve the species, because some of these events are totally devastating. They're going to wipe out the human race. There's not going to be a human race. Some of the events in past history, if you look at the mass extinctions on Earth, wiped out everything but the smallest creepy crawly little creature that lived in the water. And remember that the water is a great buffer for any of these events. So that's where the majority of success would be genetically as far as survival. Things living on the land do not fare very well. And once again, I talk about this in my weather book. There's a whole list of charts. And by the way, I just want to encourage people. I'm out of time again, but I'll be here next week with part 5 of this same set of topics on Planet X. Remember to go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and get your Dalton water filter. Be prepared to take care of yourself. And by the way, that helps to support this show, too, which I basically do commercial-free, pay for the airtime. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.